Thank you for Jenny. Session 336, titled Old Habits Die Hard, Mormon Paradigms, Post-Belief. Before we begin, we ask the cell phones are turned off. Those attending will be respectful and attentive. It's the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of the presentation. Those cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session is being recorded and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor if you haven't already. Please consider subscribing to Sunstone Magazine and the registration desk as well. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long. We ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so you can allow the next session, which is lunch, to start on time. While those leaving the church may reject the truth claims of their erstwhile faith, some of their thoughts patterns remain. This session will discuss the most common Mormon paradigms that ex-Mormons tend to retain and how it impacts our worldview. John Larson will be speaking today. He holds a BA in linguistics from BYU and an MBA from WSU. He is the former host of the Mormon Expression podcast and the current executive director of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. John is a project manager at the University of Utah Hospital. He lives in SLC with his two children. Please give a round of applause for John.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for coming. In the last few years, I've had the pleasure of meeting a lot of people inside and outside the church. But there's a group that's particularly interesting, and that's people who have nothing to do with Mormonism but find all this really interesting. So I've had a lot of conversations with these folks from all over the world, and it's always fascinating to hear what they have to say. And one thing they've always said to me, that at first I argued with them about, they said, well, ex-Mormons and Mormons are exactly the same. And I said, no. One group drinks coffee, the other group doesn't drink coffee. We're completely different. But the longer I went down the path, the more I started realizing that they're right. And that there is a stage when people leave the church between when they're ex-Mormons, which are just Mormons flipped upside down, before they become regular people. So I want to talk about some of those things today, and I've got four of them in particular. There's probably more than that. Who's got the soundboard? Someone needs to turn it down. There's probably more than that, and maybe we'll open it up to the ones that you've all noticed. This is not an indictment against ex-Mormons, although it's going to sound like an anti-ex-Mormon speech. These things are not necessarily intrinsically bad. So even though I'll make fun of them a little bit, they're just worldviews. They just are. They just are what people have. And our worldviews are deep. And oftentimes we don't see them. And this is the sort of thing you see argued about in circles about privilege and race and all these kind of things. These structures that we have are oftentimes so fundamental to the way we're processing everything else that we don't even realize we have them. And it's only when you start seeing and comparing populations that interact that you can start teasing them out. So let's just jump right in. Paradigm number one, true service is free. There are a lot of brilliant things that were done in the course of Mormonism. Ways of viewing the world, ways of motivating people to do things. I think this one is one of the most clever, ingenious, and insidious. Is that better? That was ever devised. And I don't even think there's an author. Somewhere along the line it emerged. And it's the idea that everything the church gives us for free. Now, why is that a strange idea? Because we pay out the nose. 10% is a lot of money. And not only that, but we volunteer all of our time. We do tons and tons and tons of things. And if you categorize all the things that the church demands of its adherents, it is an enormous amount of service, time, effort, treasure that's handed over to the church. And yet, most Mormons believe that they're getting this thing for free. Is that bugging anybody else besides me? Okay, so How does this play out for ex-Mormons? Ex-Mormons stop giving money to the church, and most of them stop giving money to anybody, frankly, for a little while, but they still think everything should be free. And they have this notion that anybody even asking for money is somehow violating some protocol of freeness, that the good things come from free. And it's a fascinating thing. Once, a few years ago, I was still in the church at this time, and I was in business in Kansas City. So I went over to the Community of Christ Temple, as you do, and we went through the tour, and I was sitting there with some co-workers, and we were just sitting in the temple, the beautiful temple with the spire. And a group of Utah Mormons were on tour. And I know they were Utah Mormons because they made sure everybody knew they were Utah Mormons. They came in, we'd already started the tour, but they demanded that they come in on it. And they all came and sat as a block, and they were making passive-aggressive, snarky comments so loud that everyone could see. Now, they had no idea who I was or that there were other people who were Mormons. But one thing that I thought was interesting is they kept belittling the temple for its ostentatious display. Now, I don't know if you've been to the Community of Christ Temple. It sits somewhere in on that realm between, I don't know, the Salt Lake Temple and a West Valley church house. It's somewhere right in the middle. It's not really ostentatious. But this gives a pattern of how this thought pattern plays out for Mormons. Mormons don't necessarily see that connection between money, wealth, and what they're doing. So there's a common refrain, at least there was when I was young, among teaching about ostentatious display. That was a sign of apostasy. That was a sign that the Catholic Church was not the true church because they spent so much money. And meanwhile, up on the hill, lit by God knows what candlelight power, is on those temples with the finest materials from around the world, imported teak and mahogany and stone. But that connection between the money that is spent on the temple to display this and their own giving, A, and B, the connection that this money spent by other people is somehow a sign that they are not doing things correctly, is this powerful, powerful mind pattern. So then we go out into the world of post-Mormonism. And post-Mormonism is this interesting mix. It's its constant boil, in part because it is a state of time rather than a state of being. So if you go to these communities and you go to them 2 years later, you'll find they're all different people because people move on with their lives, as they should. But one of the things that they're doing is they're trying to form groups, but they can't let anybody hold the purse. Because to hold the purse would be to show that you're collecting money off of religion, and collecting money off of religion is bad because that's what we've been taught our whole lives. So these groups try to form over and over again, and I've seen it happen over and over again, where over petty sums of money, the groups fall apart, not because they don't want to give money, but they don't want anybody to even have money because money is dirty. It's happened over and over again. The most I've ever gone to bat for John DeLynn is because he asked for money. I've asked for money. A lot of people ask for money. Nobody has ever made their services pay only. But even getting on a podcast and saying, hey, this is hard work. If you want to throw me a penny, do so, please. But otherwise, enjoy it. That will light up Reddit every time somebody does it. And if you read the underlying comments, if you really dig in, it's because there's this paradigm that says John DeLynn is practicing priestcraft. But it's not the Mormons who think that. Oh, did we lose sound? Oh, geez. It's not the Mormons who think that. It's the ex-Mormons who think John DeLynn is practicing priestcraft. Because that pattern of thought and assumption on where money should go for good service is so deeply ingrained. And it's a fascinating thing. And what it's done is it's made for those. There's tons and tons of people who've tried to work to build positive landing grounds for ex-Mormons and therapists and that sort of stuff. And the inability to raise money is so cumbersome that almost all the organizations fail under this weight, which is really quite interesting if you think about it. There's these people who who really, really, really want the church to suffer, right? And then there's organizations that pop up that could aid in that, but there's a strong, strong resistance to even the slightest penny. And I, after talking to people for years and years, it finally dawned on me that it was from that old paradigm of what the church did. So if you want to start a business yourself, if you can get people to give you money and think that you're doing things for free, man, that's going to be a recipe for success. I applaud them for it. Okay, that's paradigm number one. Paradigm number two is that the private social habits of individuals need to be either governed or justified. Now, this plays out in some interesting ways. The number one way, of course, is Mormons and ex-Mormons' unhealthy preoccupation with sex. And they just can't let it go. But so this plays out very differently. So for Mormons, there's oftentimes this darkness, this shadow of sexuality, where it doesn't want to be discussed. It's confessed in behind closed doors. People who have affairs or otherwise do a public act. Mormons are actually very good these days, not in 1847, but of not publicly shaming people, of trying to keep it on the down low, and that sort of element. Now, ex-Mormons reverse that. Ex-Mormons have a habit of promiscuous disclosure. You go to a party with a bunch of ex-Mormons, you're going to hear everything they ever did, because they're still playing on the same element. Now, in the work that I've done, I've talked to a lot of psychologists and therapists and sex therapists, and this idea, for example, that sex is dirty and sex is shameful, plays out in a lot of unhealthy ways. It pumps up the deep, dark underground. I mean, we're all familiar with the statistic that says, you know, Utah is the number one subscriber to porn. Make sure to get that. It's not that Utah is the number one user of porn. They're most likely to pay for it. I guess that's out of honesty or whatever. And then we saw recently that Ashley Madison, of course, which is the website for affairs, Salt Lake City was the number four user in the world of this site, which might be disclosed. So we might find out who all the users are really shortly here, which would be kind of fun. But these elements play in both sides of this equation. And as I've talked to some therapists, one therapist who had been working with a lot of ex-Mormons asked me and said, why do ex-Mormons get off so much on the fact that sex is dirty? Because it starts fueling the way we connect these things, and it leads to these unhealthy elements. Now, what I was talking about is the private social habits need to be governed or justified. So in the years that I've been working in the ex-Mormon communities, the most prevalent, what do I want to call these? Kerfuffles, big blow-ups online, usually are sex scandals within the ex-Mormon community. Now, I'm not going to give you a catalog of all of them or go through the detail, but suffice it to say that they're there. And oftentimes they will result from people who have different lifestyles and different choices and different boundaries on sexuality getting together because they all think they're on the same page, i.e. they're all ex-Mormons. So they get together and somebody gets drunk and takes their top off. All right, you know, ex-Mormons are, we're all frat kids. We understand that. The ex-Mormons are going through their rumspringa. And that's not what I'm trying to criticize here. What I'm trying to say is what's fascinating is what happens after that top comes off, which is there will be shaming and there will be outrage and there will be questions and what's appropriate and what's not appropriate, rather than, I think, in outside of Mormonism, there's more of an attitude of shrugging your shoulders and going into the other room. And this idea that we have to understand and say what is right and what is not right, what's good and what's not good. We're going to form two Mormon Stories groups here. This one is for the swingers, this one's for the non-swingers. And we're going to sit and we're going to police all this stuff. And we're going to say what can be done and what can't be done. And then on the same right, the ex-Mormons have to then justify all their stuff. I don't want to know who you sleep with. I don't care. And you don't have to make the case that sexual act has to be acknowledged. Luckily, in my experience, again, these things move on. That they run their course, and we're able to get from them. Okay, third paradigm is anti-pluralism. We know that us and them constructions are pretty well baked into our DNA. It appears they're fairly universal. And it'd be mistaken for me to point out that Mormons have an us and them paradigm, and ex-Mormons have an us and them paradigm, because everybody has an us and them paradigm. But what I think is really fascinating is this struggle for dominance, that not a mere acknowledgement that the other's folks are here and we're going to live pluralistically and these people are free to believe whatever stupid things they want, but a struggle to shape what happens. Like, why are Mormons so preoccupied with the liquor laws? I can understand why Mormons would say, we don't want people drinking alcohol in the state of Utah. That makes sense. That's their religion, and I have news for people. Utah liquor laws are not uniquely weird. They're strange all over the United States. They're strange all over the world. But there seems to be this wanting to niggle in those things and decide where drinks can be mixed and how many drinks you can have on the table and all this stuff that just seems bizarre from an outside perspective. Again, against a pluralistic view. It's not the view of saying, I'm going to go to Chili's and I'm going to have a virgin margarita and you can put a little something-something in yours and you're over there on that table and that's fine. It's, no, I'm going to eat this table. I want to make sure that you're not doing this at this table and that my community knows. I think another great example of this is the desire to shut down like pools, community pools on Sunday. And when it comes up and say, well, there's usage of the pools, people pay for them and whatnot, it's still this idea that we don't want a pluralistic view on these pools. We want the pools and our society to match what things are doing. Well, I see the same thing. The ex-Mormons don't have nearly as much political clout and political power, but you'll see ex-Mormons complain a lot about like churches on every corner. Why do they care? What does it matter? If the churches are there and the people are going inside and doing their own thing, that's pluralism. Free speech is the right of other people to say things you don't want them to say, really. And a pluralistic society means that we allow other people to do their own thing. Now, where that crosses the line is when you start trying to influence what other people can do. And that's the point I'm getting at, is that this anti-pluralism takes, and you have ex-Mormons who want to stop Mormon display, or a great example is the Days of 47 parade, and something like calling it Pie and Beer Day. It's a cute joke, but it is sort of antagonistic, let's acknowledge. I mean, here's people who are celebrating their heritage, they're celebrating the Mormon foundation of the state, and then there's a tendency to want to kind of shut that down and say, you can't do that anymore, and we don't want that sort of thing. Even though let them march down, let everybody march down, let everybody have their parade, who cares? So this, in my mind, comes from the bias in Mormonism, the strong bias of a true and false dichotomy. So a lot of religions believe, and I did not understand this for years and years, and I really didn't understand until I got out of the religion, because I would argue that all religions believe they're either true or false. But it's not that simple. And modern religions, however you want to call them, these fundamentalist religions like Scientology and Mormonism and the Jehovah's Witnesses, they get really caught up on this proving that they are true at the expense of everything else being false. And that true-false paradigm really, really drives hard into their religious view and how they deconstruct and look at the world. And that black and white when it comes to religion. Now, don't get me wrong, Mormonism is what Mormonism is, but that insistence on orthodoxy, that there is a right and true religion and there's a right and true way to do things, and it doesn't matter who believes what, it matters if you have the right ordinances by the right people in the right direction, at the right place, at the right time, and all that kind of stuff pulls right along when people go outside the church, which is why they become so preoccupied with deconstructing every little nitpicky detail of Mormonism, which I am very guilty of, right? I'm one of the ones who followed this paradigm. And from my view, you could constantly prove Mormonism to be untrue by taking apart every little nitpicky detail. But that's because I had this same paradigm. I probably still do. This hyper-orthodoxy. There is a way that things are done, and there's a way that things aren't done. And I have been in countless arguments with liberal Mormons who explain to me their belief, and like a big asshole, I'll tell them they're wrong because here's the proof text of what you actually believe, right? But that's me imposing a false paradigm on them. Religion is an individual view. I don't have any right to tell you. Now, I can say, hey, you know, you belong to an organization that does X, Y, and Z, that spent this much money on Prop 8. So I know you might be for, you know, equality of, you know, the LGBT community, but your organization should pay tithing to is not. That's fair. But for me to tell them, no, to insist that you have to believe a certain thing or that you have to be a certain way is a paradigm that I brought with me from the church. The last one, I think, is the most important one that I have here. That's that Mormonism is super special. This one fuels so much of what goes on in the debates. Now, I want to be clear of what we're talking about. Sunstone and other such outlets are really about Mormon studies. It's about, you know, trying to analyze and understand and communicate and dialogue about these things. So that's not what I'm criticizing here, but about people who are preoccupied with the specialness of Mormonism. And I don't mean to say that, like, Mormonism is particularly weird or anything. It's not. As a matter of fact, that's part of what the point I'm making here. Mormonism is an interesting religion that arose in America during an interesting period of time. And it's been successful for many, many interesting reasons. But it's not because it's special. And what you'll see is, I remember when I was young, any time the New York Times or whatever would run an article on Mormonism, especially if it had any sort of negative tint whatsoever, which, let's face it, any article about any topic, most journalists will put in positive and negative things. It's hard to find an article about any topic that doesn't have some sort of negative brush to it. I challenge you to go do it. But what we would do is, the New York Times would write about Mormonism once every 7 years, and they would put a slight somewhere in paragraph 17, and then we would all see how they're talking about Mormonism. Why does everybody care so much about Mormonism? They don't. We have a disposition to look at those things. When I lived in North Carolina for a few years, I was really interested to then see what articles on Mormonism would surface through the press and then kind of compare them to others. And I saw that people weren't particularly interested about Mormonism. And even being outside the church, I expected that they were. And this was a time during Prop 8, right? I thought the world was paying close attention to this stuff. And then we had the Mormon moment. I got news for you. We're not that special. There's people who are talking about these sort of issues that we're talking to about all over the place. I'll give you some examples about how this plays out. Ex-Mormons are really, really interested in church statistics. Now, the church produces its own statistics with no audit and with no justification for the data. And, you know, and we know things that they say, like the church, if the church loses you, it will count you as a member until you're 110. The church says that. Why does anybody care what the church says? I can't tell you how many times in discussions I've quoted that passage from 1984 about boot production. There's a big passage saying that the government said they completed 350,000 pairs of boots, but they might have completed 200 or 500. Nobody knows, because it's the government telling you what they're doing. Maybe there were no boots produced at all. Maybe everybody has boots. Who knows? But you'll get this statistical driving of the church's own statistics that have no foundation whatsoever. Why does anybody care? Well, people don't. The only people who care are Mormons and ex-Mormons. And so the church claims this many or this many that or this many the other, and they get into big debates about these numbers, and it's all vacuous. Another is the word of wisdom. People don't care. This was a big thing for me. I remember being at a conference. This is when I was young, working my first job, and I specifically didn't drink Sprite because I didn't want people to think that I was drinking champagne or wine or whatever it is they drunk, all those heathens. So I had a Coke. Well, let me tell you something about mixed drinks. A lot of them are mixed with Coke. Like there's no, and then so I then later I was at a conference, this is after I left the church, and I was next to somebody who was a member, and they came drinking a milk. Apparently, these guys never saw The Big Lebowski because there are the whole line of drinks that you mix in white liquid, right? But the point is, nobody cares. As a matter of fact, the world's full of alcoholics. If you go to a party and say, I'm not going to have a drink, nobody pushes you, except ex-Mormons. They'll push you. But the rest of the world knows better. They have an uncle, whoever's in recovery, and they do not want to have that conversation with you. They do not want to hear about your sponsor or how many years you've been without a drink. They don't want to know. And they don't care what you have in your glass. But we think they do. Matter of fact, the word of wisdom is so complicated and hard to understand, nobody else gets it but us. And they know that we don't drink coffee, and then some Mormons drink Coke, and then we don't drink alcohol, and after that they don't care. But we think these things are really super important. We talked about Mormon news, we talked about the Mormon moment. So I think what's really interesting is the way these interactions happen and the way these things happen in the communities. So the very fascinating thing of why these paradigms of belief, these paradigms of Mormonists that ex-Mormons take with them are so important is because of how they form communities in the beginning. I noticed really early, I don't want to sound terrible when I say this, that when you go to an ex-Mormon party or a get-together, what's really fascinating is that all of the classes of people are mixing together, which normally doesn't happen. You know, like when you go to Lagoon or you go to places like that and you're like, where did all the unwashed come from? I don't see these. Well, that's because you surround yourself in your little privileged corner of Sandy and you don't interact with people who aren't like you. And then suddenly you go to some place like the State Fair and you're like, oh my God, where did all these people come from? Well, they're here. You just shield yourself in your little privileged bubble and you never see them. And when you go to your cocktail parties, whatever it is you people do, you're surrounding yourself with people who are just like you. Except when you go to an ex-Mormon party. And then everybody's mixing together because the only thing they have in common is the fact that they were not Mormons. And I can't tell you how many times this happened. Again, I'm going to sound like a dick. People will come to me and they'll say, you must hear a lot of people's exit stories. And I say, yes, I do. You must not like that. No, I really don't. I'd rather talk about anything else. I mean, I appreciate people. I appreciate their stories. But I've heard them, and it's not my favorite thing at a cocktail party. And then they say, oh, I bet that's terrible. Let me tell you about my story. Because that's what they have in common with me, right? That's the only connection they have. And they know my story, so now they want to tell me theirs. So when we first leave the church, the only thing we have in common is that we were all members at one time. And we all are processing the world in this same way, and we all have the same sort of outrage that is fueled by the fact that because of these things, we feel really super special. Our Mormonism gave us identity, and it did me. It gave me a place in the world. And I've said this before, growing up and my whole time in the church was not negative. There was nothing negative about it. They were my people and I was one of them, and it made me feel special. The world is a really complicated place with a lot of stuff coming down on us. And when you have the word of wisdom, then that's one less thing you need to worry about. You don't need to say, okay, is coffee good for us this year or not? Is it going to exacerbate my kidney stones? Or is it going to make me hyperproductive? Or what's the research saying? You just don't have to worry about all that. It's easy. And when you're an ex-Mormon, you don't have to worry about either. The church says don't take cocaine, so cocaine must be awesome. Let's go have some. It's really easy for a while because you don't have to process these hard decisions. You don't have to figure out what it's like to live in the world. But what I find more interesting now is as these paradigms start sliding away and people start really engaging, I've told the story before, but there were, as one does when they leave the church, they tend to find peers who are leaving at about the same time they are, and then they kind of go on their life journey together, and they replug in with one another. It's a great thing. And Nate was there at my house. I think, Nate, you pulled down my shower curtain. It was an accident, he says. He was drunk. So the party and the table in my kitchen, it was just full of all these bottles of skanky alcohol from the bottom shelf. And there was just tons and tons of that. These are all middle-aged, like middle-class people with kids acting like frat kids. And then I moved to North Carolina and came back, and we had another get-together a year later, and it was all wine sipping, right? Like they'd gone through their phase and they'd found their rhythm with alcohol, and it it had to do with getting sleep and stuff like that, that's more often. But what we were doing was a reaction to the church. We were following DNC 89 probably more so than the Mormons were, because we had to prove that we weren't beholden to DNC 89. And we were going to prove it by embedding every substance that it says not to take there, especially meat in times of non-famine. I really like that one. All right, so I think there's others out there, and I'm interested to hear which ones that you've noticed about. But Mormons, ex-Mormons, they're all the same people, and that's my stand. All right, any questions? Or I want to hear other paradigms that you've all noticed. None? Sorry to shame you publicly, Nathan. Go ahead.
The desire to do missionary work.
The desire to do missionary work. Absolutely. There was a group. I'm scanning the audience to see who I'm going to offend. That actually printed pass-along cards. Ex-Mormons printed pass-along cards and started putting them onto. It's clear. And you know, one of the things that fuels missionary work, I believe, is this feeling that you're so right that if anybody else just hears what you have to say, they're immediately going to jump on board with you. It's this overwhelming sensation that I remember once when I was about 15, I was sitting in seminary, I had a really great time, I felt the Spirit. I'm like, how is the whole world not buying this? Why isn't everybody a Mormon? This is fantastic. And that missionary zeal gets reawoken in the ex-Mormons, right? And they burn. There are a lot of relationship problems, and I don't mean to make light of them, between families and friends and coworkers. But let's be honest, a lot of those are fueled by ex-Mormons and their zeal to make sure everybody knows that they have now left the church. I get it. There is a strong sense, and you can read lots of anthropological literature about this, that when you feel like you've been the victim of a fraud, that you want to blow a whistle. And I don't know if that's a fair thing to say about the church. I think it's probably not. But I think it's fair to say that people have that emotional reaction, right? That they feel like they've been duped, and they want to make sure everyone knows that they are no longer in dupedhood, or whatever the word is. But, you know, it's the same zeal, right? Absolutely. Yes, ma'am. You can't turn down callings and lack of boundaries. The second one especially. Yeah, I talked a little bit. I briefly talked about promiscuous disclosure. That goes to the lack of boundaries sort of thing. And can't turn down callings. One thing that I've noticed in doing nonprofit work and some of the things we try to do is we try to build ex-Mormon communities is this tendency, what you're talking about, to volunteer for things that they really don't want to do and then disappear. That ex-Mormons ghost a lot of things that they commit to, and I think it's that, because we're conditioned to not say no, right? And it's something you could absolutely hate, and I do think that they take that on, and a sense of responsibility too. Yeah, I think that's a clever one. What's that?
Goes along with your home teaching. I'll totally do it.
Oh yeah. Yeah, the home teaching thing. I think home teaching is, let me go out on a limb. Home teaching is a good idea, just poorly executed. Yes, sir.
Along with the statistic thing, I think Mormons like to think of themselves as part of the greatest movement that's falling forth and developing the whole person. So the next Mormons, when they leave, they're thinking that everyone's leaving now. You know, they could possibly say, oh, part of the
Yeah, the comment is that Mormons think of themselves as this great movement, the rock cut out of the hill or whatever, it's rolling forward and gaining momentum. There's more and more people joining. And as you wisely pointed out, ex-Mormons think they are doing the same thing. What I realized, we have crossed I don't have statistics to prove this, but bear with me. I think we've crossed a point in Salt Lake City that there are more ex-Mormons than there are Mormons. But not everybody in Salt Lake City who's an ex-Mormon is an ex-Mormon. Because there's people who take a lot of their identity from ex-Mormonism. I obviously was one. And I've done some thinking about what drives that, and I think it's because I took so much identity from being a Mormon. So that left a vacuum in my life. But if you go anywhere in Salt Lake City, go join a bowling league or go to the urban arts community, you'll find that most of these people are ex-Mormons. They just don't care that they're ex-Mormons. So I think very much so it's that, and the same thing happens in the church. There's people who have really a lot of missionary zeal. Most of us kind of went along and we were mouthing the words and, you know, we were trying, but we didn't have the same zeal that the other people did. But there's some ex-Mormons that just really have that zeal. They want to bring the church down. I think it's a very Mormon way of thinking. Yes, sir?
Continued desire for structure because structure feels safe.
Continued desire for structure. I'm going to air my own laundry. There's a subset of people that way who want to put structure on other people. Right? There's guys who go form nonprofits to say, oh, the ex-Mormons, they need help, right? And that's definitely an element of that looking for structure. And what you've seen, I've talked about these communities, it sounds like all ex-Mormons do is sit together and drink. That's not exactly true. They oftentimes do lots of things where they're trying to build this structure. And I think it goes to the us and them sort of thing. Like, why, if they want their kids involved in summer camps, like there's a really great Jewish center right up here that runs a fantastic summer camp. Why don't they just all go join it? Why do they feel like they have to create their own instead of taking the resources that are out there? And I think it goes to that point I was making, that us and them. We're ex-Mormons. We're special. No one else gets our story. No one else really understands us. You know, they're like 14-year-old girls. So, go ahead. Yes.
And I think kind of in the church, you have a church versus worldview type of dichotomy. And I think when you're stepping away from the church, you kind of feel like you're joining the world, and then sort of you're becoming a part of the wider human family. But I think that's kind of illusory, because the church is a part of the world already. So you're not really stepping out into something bigger, because a lot of the problems that are in the church are in the world, and you know, it's all one thing.
That's a fantastic point. What he said is, as a member of the church, you have Mormonism, the church, and then you have the world out there. And so what ex-Mormons sometimes do is they say, well, I left the church, now I'm part of the world. And that's really illusionary, because as he pointed out, Mormonism is part of the world. It's a component of this big mix of cultures and attitudes and whatever else that's out there. And so there's this idea of this universalism. I see you find it in, and when I say this, I really enjoy like scientific writers and the skeptics and that sort of thing. Not as much as I did when I first left the church. But you'll see like a lot of ex-Mormons start posting a lot of like scientific and social causes on their websites where they've replaced that. And I think you have a really excellent point. What they've done is that identity of being Mormon, it gets replaced with this identity of being a citizen of the world. But the world, as you point out, is sort of illusionary. It's not really there. And that's where I see, as I've watched people move out, they tend to find their community and their niche, but there's this universalism that sort of promotes, which I can very well see, like you're saying, is a reversal of a Mormon view. Yeah, I think that's clever. Yes, sir? That's a fantastic one. That a lot of people will reverse their political leaning. It's something I didn't understand. For me personally, my narrative, I didn't change my political views. That was part of the problem. I was a liberal Mormon, which made Mormonism sort of get a dissonance to me. But I've met plenty of people, just like you say, who are full-on conservatives, wheat-storing, gun-toting, you know, all that sort of stuff. And then they go full bleeding heart reversal in a matter of a day, and it gives us all whiplash. Because of what they're doing, they're literally just inverting all of their positions. And you can see it because they tend to become rather shrill on things like Facebook about these elements in the beginning. Tom, are you one of the shrill ones?
I'm not shrill.
Yes, ma'am. Back to you on the second one. So what she said, which I think is really good, is that we have some really deep-seated beliefs that oftentimes we don't recognize. If we're deprocessing or changing our faith, we'll change some of it but not realize that there were things underneath, which is the thing we've been on tonight. And you brought up a really great one, which is the idea that there's gurus who have the answer. Of course, in Mormonism, that paradigm comes from our prophet culture. You know, these guys, they know what's best for us. And then oftentimes, people take that there are a lot of Mormons who don't become the typical atheistic, hedonistic ex-Mormon, but they go from being a Mormon to being a Baptist. We just don't talk about them as much. And oftentimes you see that paradigm that they just shift one investiture in one method of truth to another one. And I would say that what you're talking about happens with ex-Mormons sometimes in becoming really iconoclastic, right? So they become anti-authoritarian. Because anybody who has sort of authority or structure or power must therefore be false, because they take and say the Mormon structure of following in line with some kind of authority must be corrupt somehow. So I see it play out in both ways, in just taking it and moving it and investing it in someplace else, like how ex-Mormons talk about Dawkins. You know, like they're using the exact same language they used to talk about the Quorum of the Twelve, or just saying this all is becoming like very wanting to flatten all structures and very socialistic in terms of social. Now, say your second one. I thought that one was good too. So she absolutely. So she's mentioning unconscious bias that we have directed towards ourself. The example she ended up with is like women's roles in structures with patriarchy and whatnot. And you'll see that play out quite a bit. It's a very fascinating question in groups like Feminist Mormon Housewives, as individuals struggle with that, with where do I fit in the structure? What is my bias towards authority, towards maleness, towards femaleness, towards what women should be doing, what's right and what's wrong? And I think we see those all the time surface on ourselves, that we might be, you know, one year in the church really admire Sister Smith, who stays home with her kids, does a lot of toll painting, and really has a really well put together house. And then 2 years later, we really have venom towards Sister Smith because she stays at home and spends time with her kids and has a well put together house. And I think it's really kind of finding our place in the world. And I want to reemphasize the fact that one element about Mormonism that played out for a lot of people is that we were told that we were very special, that we were being held for the last days, that the reason we were white and delightsome and all that is because we were valiant in the pre-existence. And you get pumped with all this stuff. And then you think you're really super special, and then you realize that the church isn't true, so now you're extra super-de-duper special, because you were one of the elites who was super elite and could then deconstruct it. So I do think there is an arrogance that gets walked around with, right? Yes, sir, way in the back. Yeah, the comment is about governing structures and patriarchy and patriarchal elements within ex-Mormonism. It plays out quite a bit. There's a structure, of course, of what we should do. And what I've oftentimes said, what Mormonism is really sort of the American dream of the 1950s that's put into a religious context, right? So it's like Mad Men without all the sex and alcohol. So what happens is when you leave that, now you have these same structures around. You have podcasts or blogs or organizations that are headed and run by men, and say, are we following in the exact same paradigm? And how do we escape the patriarchy? How do we have to deconstruct it? Are we just following that same paradigm again? Is it even patriarchal? Who knows? And I see, and these are really fascinating debates. And you know, one of them that plays out in ex-Mormon circles quite a bit is if you take what would consider be labeled a patriarchal position and then put a woman in that patriarchal position, is she now a sellout to the patriarchy, or is she challenged the system? And I think these questions are so fundamental to our identities as ex-Mormons because they're really fucking hard to tease apart, right? That's a really complicated question. And that's why arguments about privilege are so nuanced and so maddening, because it's really, really hard to figure out where these things, where the influence of them ends and other individual elements begin. So I think, yeah, it really, really defines the culture, not just in that some of those structures come in play, like women deferring to men in leadership positions or men seizing leadership positions over women. Those things definitely happen. But in just sort of, well, what else do we do? You know, for example, the board of directors of Whitefields is majority female. It's been that way for a long time on purpose, because I'm a man, so I want the board of directors to be majority female. And that has been really, really hard to do, because there's a lot of interesting, clever women who tend to demur. They say, I don't want to sit in that position, but the men really like it. They want another title after their name. So it's a struggle. On all sides, and it's one that I've violated many times. I'm not innocent of this, but it's a really difficult one to play out, and I can see that on a personal level. Yes, sir.
Yeah, on the internet, there is thousands of lists of all the proofs that the Book of Mormon is true, and then there are thousands of lists of all the proofs that it's not true. And about 20% of those, I think, are written by the same people.
The comment was there's these lists on the internet that have, you know, proofs that the Book of Mormon is true on the one side and proofs that the Book of Mormon are not true. And your comment was they seem to be written by the same people, which is, yeah, they're using the same reasoning, then they're oftentimes just flipping it upside down, right? And that goes to my thing about Mormons being super special, you know, like these arguments that don't really play outside of the Coliseum. Yes, ma'am. Yes.
But in my experience, I live in Warren. I left the church, and I'm still surrounded by mostly active Mormons. And I kind of feel like ashamed. And I think that comes from a tendency in the church. It's discouraged to like share anything about yourself that might be different or bad. And I feel like having left the church, I still feel like not comfortable sharing those things about myself.
Mm-hmm.
So,
the comment was, you know, she said she lives in Orem, and having left the church, you know, this sense of not being able to express her identity or being able to sort of be true to yourself in the community. It's a real issue, and it funnels some of these things. And that's why if you just judge ex-Mormons by their get-togethers, it's not a good judge of their character or their person, because oftentimes they're facing that down. But one thing I'm fascinated with on this front is, I think it's an American thing. I've decided it's an American thing. All Americans believe they're persecuted. And then Christians believe they're more persecuted, and Mormons believe they're more persecuted than that. And, you know, you get this debate, as we've just seen the recent Supreme Court decision on marriage, and everybody's a victim, right? But really, I mean, there are real victims out there. Let's be clear. But not most people aren't victims. Like, it doesn't really impact. And I think there's an element of feeling like you're persecuted because people disagree with you, that we feel, and we feel very strongly. In John DeLynn's session, he was talking about how difficult it is that when he was excommunicated, how people he had known for 10 or 11 years changed the way they interacted with him. And that's something that every ex-Mormon has experienced in a very visceral way, which sort of pumps up that persecution complex, which is really common to human beings again. And then they get in their forums, their echo chambers, and they just start railing on it. And you're like, what are you talking about? Why are you so upset about this little thing in the Book of Mormon or this thing that happened 150 years ago? What they're upset about is the person who lived three houses down, who they thought were good friends, and they went on play dates together, no longer will talk to them. And what the person who is on the other side of that equation, they're upset their friend who they went on play dates with, now they don't know them. They don't trust them because they have no paradigm for dealing with somebody who's left the church. They're a turncoat, and they feel a mix of love and repulsion at the same time that plays out in these ways. We go into our corners on social media and just blow it up because we want some sort of outlet. But my point, again, is that the person on this side of the playdate and the person on this side of the playdate are feeling the same thing emotionally. They're feeling betrayal. They're feeling lost. They're feeling the lack of love. I think it's a great point. Yes, sir?
I think we've kind of talked about this a little bit, but just the idea of a need for certainty, and both about the goodness of the self and I think about truth. And there's this really, so that's where a lot of this stuff comes from. I think that just that desire for certainty, and it just stays.
Yeah, the comment is the desire for certainty and the desire for truth. And this comes from, you know, I was talking about the us and them paradigm that's kind of pumped up by orthodoxy and truth and that sort of thing. And I know that for me, I had an existential struggle when I first lost my faith, and I'm still going to church. I'm still trying to make it work because I felt a strong desire to find the truth. I had the truth, I lost the truth, and now there's a truth-shaped hole in my soul which I had to fill. I later learned that that shape is scotch, and it fills it just fine. But at the time, I was looking for the truth. And the single most important epiphany I ever had, to me, I know I've told people before and they're like, I don't know what you're talking about. But this was a pivotal moment in my life when I realized that the truth existed independent of my awareness of it. I am either going to die and be done with when I'm dead, or I'm going to have an afterlife. That is intrinsically so. And what I believe about it matters nothing. It's either going to happen or it's not. And no amount of missionary zeal, no amount of converting people to my way of thinking, no amount of yoga or whatever is going to change that fact. And once that I realized that, I could let it go. I didn't have to solve this problem. Because what Mormonism is, and a lot of religions are, is a solution to a problem. Life is complicated. It's messy. It doesn't make sense. It's hard. It hurts. And so religion is oftentimes a paradigm that solves that. It gives people meaning. I firmly believe that Christianity spread through the Roman Empire in part because it gave a slave class and an impoverished people some meaning beyond their shitty lives that they were living. And that's a powerful thing. And I think that's a powerful thing for all of us today. And I think that's what pumps these things up, is as you lose that, you got to find something else. Sometimes it's scotch. Yes, sir. I don't drink that much scotch. It's expensive. Go ahead.
A lot of Mormons like to say, hey, you know, my life is so blessed. And the next Mormons are like, my life is destroyed because I don't get the blessings. So look how great I am now. It's kind of what I've noticed.
Yeah, the comment was a lot of Mormons like to emphasize how their lives are blessed, and they, you know, they have blessings, and da-da-da-da-da. And there's an emphasis among ex-Mormons, and this is really when I can tell that they've made the change on a personal level. Because they get a lot of pressure, there's an element to try to say, look how much better my life is now that I'm an ex-Mormon than it was before. I can drink scotch. So nanner nanner, you can't do that. And there's an element of saying, look how fantastic things are. And because they don't want to fail, they don't want to play into those paradigms. And we know that they're out there. We've all heard them in church saying, Sister Smith, she quit going to Sunday school, she hooked up with some loose men, and now look at her. So there's a desire to revolt against that and an insistence that everything is fine. One of the things with Whitefields that I'm trying to do is to get more people to go to therapy, and rather than work through these things in booze-filled orgies with their ex-Mormon friends, to find somebody who's dispassionate to talk to. And it is really, really hard to get ex-Mormons to go to therapy the first 2 years. First of all, there's a bias against therapy in Mormon culture in general. And secondly, they are so caught up in a self-deception that everything is better, and they don't want to acknowledge that some things are in fact worse. That it takes usually a couple years before they're really ready to acknowledge that. Yes, ma'am.
I think one thing that can happen is we take with us the terror of mystery and ambiguity. There's just this terror of that shades of, not shades of gray, that shades anything between black and white. I guess it's a shade of gray.
I think it's a fantastic point. What she said is that when we leave the church, we take with us a fear, a terror, was your word, of ambiguity, of mystery, of not knowing. Because if you're in a religion, that one of its fundamental elements is we have the answers. Look at all the ad campaigns the church puts out. We know what life's about. We have all the answers. And I think culturally, Mormonism, we have a tendency to eschew things that we don't have answers for. Oh, that'll be answered in the next life, or that's a mystery. And we like to embrace the knowledge. And then you get out, you no longer have that structure of knowing everything. And my God, it's terrifying, right? And I think that's what pulled so many ex-Mormons to science and to astronomy and all that kind of stuff in the beginning. And then I think I keep talking about this element where people graduate out of this phase and become just regular human beings. And I think one of it, and it's a great place to end, is that embracing of that ambiguity. And that's where a lot of these things I've talked about, you know, this talking about organizations and us and them and pluralism and this sort of stuff. And when you kind of let that go and just say, hey, it's hard for everybody, that Mormons aren't all bad people, ex-Mormons aren't all good people, then you're much more likely to engage the world in a realistic sort of way. So excellent point. Thanks, everybody, for all your contributions.